This episode is brought to you by DorksideToys.com. For the latest Star Wars action figures, Marvel, G.I. Joe, and more, visit DorksideToys.com.
Rebel Force Radio.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Prepare to make the jump to light speed.
Light speed.
Traveling through hyperspace ain't like dusting crops, boy.
A collection of bits, comedy, and favorite moments.
Stop that ship! Blast them!
So strap yourselves in and prepare for the jump to light speed.
All right, it's Celebration Japan. We are honored to be joined by Luke Skywalker himself, Mark Hamill. How's it going, Mark?
Pretty good.
How's Japan treating you so far?
Well, I love Japan. I went to high school here for 2 years because my father was in the Navy. So my junior and senior year, I went to Yokohama High.
Wow. And can you speak Japanese at all?
I spoke much better then when it was a necessity. The problem is if you don't keep up, you forget most of it.
Right.
And what was interesting is before we got on-base housing, we lived among the Japanese. So we had to fend for ourselves. I learned more in the first summer I was here than you go on base, and you never have to speak it again.
So you forget. I mean, I took 4 years of high school and college Spanish.
Right.
You know, other than burrito, taco, that kind of thing.
I know. Well, I mean, it's like five-minute university. That's the Father Guido Sardici's five-minute university where you learn in 5 minutes at his university what most graduates remember 20 years later.
And this is Father Guido's Sardici?
Yeah. Don Novello, who used to be on Saturday Night Live, and I did this series with him, animated series, and it's hysterical because basically what do I remember from high school German? Wo ist die Bibliothek? So if I ever need to know where the library is, I'm good to go.
So
that's all.
How are Japanese Star Wars fans different from other Star Wars fans all over the world?
Well, it's overwhelming. Some of them are so close to, their emotions are so close to the surface, you know, they get really, I don't know. I mean, we've had girls weeping, even a couple of men.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, real waterworks.
Right.
And I'm trying to remember because I'm thinking, I so don't take myself seriously.
Okay.
And I'm embarrassed because I'm not, believe me, I am not worthy, just like Wayne's World. But, you know, they're really genuine and they're really, it's moving, really, that it means so much to them.
I've said it a lot over the weekend that people here are so kind and friendly and happy about what they're doing. I just want to take a little bit of that home with me to the States, you know, and
I know.
Try to spread it around.
I know.
A
We're
bit.
So cynical back home.
Do you recall the first time you heard about auditions for Star Wars?
Yeah, Robert Englund, who wound up playing Freddy Krueger, was a friend of mine. He says, have you been out for that movie that George Lucas is doing? I said, the American Graffiti guy? I said, yeah. And I said, no, what is it? He goes, it's some kind of like Flash Gordon thing. And he only told me about it after he knew he didn't get the part.
Oh, of course.
That's, actors look after themselves first. But so I just went to a big cattle call.
Mm-hmm.
There was no script. I talked to George for 5 or 10 minutes. Brian De Palma was in the room, also casting for Carrie.
Right.
And then I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks, and then someone said, you're going to test, and they're going to send you the pages. But they sent me pages. They didn't send me the whole script. So I read the scene, and I said, well, this Han Solo guy, he must be the Flash Gordon character, because he's the grown-up, and he's flying the ship.
Okay.
And I'm sort of, like, bugging him, and I'm sort of an irritant, and I seem like a juvenile. So clearly, I'll be the sidekick.
Uh-huh.
To the star of the movie.
Right.
And then when I tested, it was Harris, and I knew him from American Graffiti, and I was desperate for George to give us some indication. Is this, like, parody? Is it Mel Brooks, or is it serious, or what?
Mm-hmm.
He just said, well, just do it, and we'll talk about it later.
Right. That's his style, you know?
Yeah.
He just throws you out there.
So I really didn't know it. The best decision I made is not to send up the material. Do it as seriously as I could, which wasn't easy. You know, there was a line in the screen test that was never in the movie that I've never forgotten. I'll do it for you right now. Because it was, we're driving in the Millennium Falcon.
Right.
And Harrison goes, all right, kid, you know, I've held up my part of the bargain now, blah, blah, blah. But he's saying that he was going to go back, that, you know, that the destination wasn't the right one, or it wasn't landable, or I don't know what reason. But he's turning back, and the line was, but we can't turn back. fear is their greatest defense. I doubt if the actual security there is any greater than it was on Aquilae or Sullis, and what there is most likely directed towards a large-scale assault.
You're ready for the audition again.
I know. Well, I memorized that line almost like a Japanese person memorizes Jingle Bells by, you know, where you don't really understand it.
Yes.
You just learn it. Because I thought, who talks like this? Because I had to break it down. Aquilae or Sullis, what's that? Oh, that must be two planetoids or whatever. I mean, it made sense, but it just didn't flow the way people talk.
Right.
But, again, I thought it's not for me to judge the material and send it up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just try and be as serious as I can be, and then you know what happened.
And, of course, Harrison has that famous line, George, you can put the shit on paper, but you can't say it.
Oh, we can say that? Yeah, okay. I forget if we're on broadcast or not. Yeah, he's really... I'll tell you the line he couldn't say, and it made us laugh so hard. And you know another thing? George won't print bloopers. I don't know why. He just doesn't... At least then he wouldn't. Because the scene where Harrison had to say, it'll take a few moments for the navicomputer to calculate the coordinates.
Yes.
It'll take a few moments for the navicomputer to calculate the coordinates. Now, we were driving... We shared a car. See, the first one, we were all together. The second one, we had agents, managers, yes, boyfriends, girlfriends, blah, 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 and separate cars.
Right.
Carrie always had her separate car because she's a girl. But me and Harrison were in the same car on the first one, and on the way to work that morning, he was like a mantra. It'll take a few moments for the navicomputer to calculate the coordinates. And he's got that kind of laconic style.
Right, right.
It's like, you know, ghost it up, Harrison. Let's hear a little energy. But he, you know what he does? He does make it much more, it's going to take a while for me to figure this out,
yeah, yeah,
or whatever it is. It's not spot on, but we laugh so hard. I mean, when people say, what was it like making the movie? We laughed a lot because you had to get out of your system so that when the cameras actually turned, you could be, you know, it's all gone out, you know, you get rid of all the silliness.
Mm-hmm.
But, I thought it was hilarious.
What do you do on the set to get yourself into character?
Well, it depends. It really depends on the project, the material, whether it's in the theater, whether it's in the movies or television. I'm not an actor that stays in character between shots. I know one of my favorite stories is I'm friends with Miguel Ferrer, and he was in RoboCop, and he said that, I forget the actor, Peter Weller?
Peter Weller, yes.
Had everybody call him McMurphy or whatever his name was.
Yeah, right, right.
Even at the hotel,
yeah,
on the weekends when they weren't shooting.
Right, right.
I said, wow, that's taken the, you know, method acting pretty far.
Or like Jim Carrey when he was preparing to be in The Man in the Moon when he,
right,
played Andy Kaufman.
Right.
Word from the set was is he was always in character.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's, in a way, that's because Andy was such a specific signature role. I mean, that I totally understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned Andy Kaufman as, or Jim Carrey as Andy Kaufman. I've heard stories that, like, for instance, on W.C. Fields and Me or something, the one where Rod Steiger played W.C. Fields. He pretty much stayed in character all the time, but he was a great exponent of method acting, where Rod Steiger goes away and he just stays W.C. Fields all the time. My only story that's similar to that is that when we were working with Yoda, it spread out through the crew, so everybody started talking that way. To the commissary you are going? Hungry are you? And eventually Frank said, could you please not talk like that because I'm starting to do your version instead of keeping it pure my version. But it's very catchy.
Yeah.
That backwards talking. Backwards talking is fun, no?
I have a bunch of friends in Chicago, and sometimes we'll get in jags where we do Harry Carey's voice all the time.
Oh, sure.
Hello, everybody. And we have to make ourselves stop. We have to stop ourselves. But, okay, so back when you were auditioning for Star Wars, weren't you locked in for a role on Eight is Enough?
They did a pilot, but they changed 50% of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
They changed the director. It was just a wholesale change. I think it's very unfair of them, in retrospect, to say I left because Star Wars was so big, because it hadn't come out yet when they made that change. But, you know, it's in the on the scheme of things, it's not that important.
Well, you went, after you filmed the movie, you went out to San Diego to promote it at the San Diego Comic-Con before it was released. Any memories from that experience?
Well, it was a con back east. It wasn't the San Diego con. I think it was somewhere, maybe Chicago. James Van Heist, I remember, that fan writer. He did, can't remember the name of his magazine. I went with Gary Kurtz. And listen, I was totally down with this thing. I mean, because I thought it's funny. It's like, it's fantasy, but with humor added. Mm-hmm. So science fiction was generally very serious. You know, 2001 and Silent Running, and they, you know, it was science fiction. It was serious. And I kept thinking, well, look, this isn't science fiction, really. We've got a farm boy and a wizard and a princess and a pirate. It's more like a fairy tale. And I hadn't even seen the connection between The Hidden Fortress, the Kurosawa film that it's largely modeled after. I hadn't seen that. So I said, basically, if this thing were set, instead of spaceships, we were in horse-drawn carriages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be in medieval England. Mm-hmm. It'd be the same story and the same humor, but don't get hung up on the fact that it's science fiction. And by the way, they were focus grouping, testing the title.
Yes.
And saying that, you know, 53% of women will not go see a film that has wars in the title. So we had a contest on the set. Rename this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could put up your suggestions on the bulletin board while we were shooting the first one, because Fox would send these memos back like that with focus groups saying, you got to change the title. How about this one? 12% think that Star Wars is the story of the breakup of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton's marriage.
Really? Now,
stuff
that's
like
something
that.
I haven't heard anything like that
so,
before.
But the thing is, we were trying to come up, everybody, I don't even remember suggestions, because nobody could come up with something that was better than Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I was glad, because I said, what is better than that? That's really, to me, I really love the title.
Well, I'm glad
but
that
they would send memos like, could you put some pants on the Wookiee? And they would send sketches, like some lederhosen, you know, with straps. And you're going, if that's what they're getting from the footage, we are in big, big, big trouble. All this work, and they're looking at the Wookiee's wiener.
Yeah,
or
the
trying
Wookiee's
to
wiener.
Find it.
That's something that could be merchandised that hasn't been already. Some hot dogs
it's
called
amazing.
Wookiee wieners.
Can you imagine, I mean, a major studio, and that's their comment? Because I used to go up to Robert Watts' office and read, I guess they had telex in those days. It wasn't, you know, emails and all that.
Of course.
But he'd let me read through all this, you know, for his eyes only, comments from the studio, and I still remember lederhosen for the Wookiee.
Good Lord. Well, thank God it didn't go in that direction. Now, you're known as a fan of comic books.
Right.
And you've said consistently in the past you believed, before it was released, that Star Wars was going to be a big hit. A lot of your compatriots from the set felt otherwise,
right?
Especially the British crew. Now, being a fan of comic books, did Star Wars appeal to your fanboy sensibilities in that way?
Yeah. I mean, it not only did it appeal to the comic book side of me, but the Ray Harryhausen side of me. All the stuff I loved as a kid seemed to be encompassed in this one picture. And it was a wonderful playground with all these toys. And by the way, I said it'll be a hit. But I meant, like, even if it tanks on its initial release, it's got Midnight Cult Movie written all over it, mm-hmm. like Rocky Horror,
mm-hmm.
because of the humor.
Okay.
I said, I see college students, mm-hmm. you know, toking up their doobies.
Of course.
And going down to the theater and watching this thing, because to me it was hilarious. I mean, I had no idea that it would do what it did.
Yeah.
And even the very first day it opened, in other words, the day it opened, May whatever, in 77, that day that it opened, I was supposed to go down and dub the 35mm print, because the 70mm were already out there.
Okay.
So I had a sound recording for the 35mm print, and I said to the driver who picked me up, can we go by Grauman's Chinese to see where it's playing?
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't agree on a poster, so there was no poster. They stapled lobby cards up.
Mm-hmm.
There was
mm-hmm.
no poster yet. And to my astonishment, there were lines around the block. Day one.
Yeah.
In the day.
Right.
So I said, how could this be? And he said, well, it's probably you were on a good weekend. There was only one other thing opening. The movie by William Friedkin, movie about transporting nitroglycerin. I forget the title. But in any case, I guess it was just a lot of things on our side that we see. May 25th in those days was a good 3 weeks before the big summer rush started.
That's right.
That set the tent pole earlier, and now it's gone back and back and back. But I couldn't believe my eyes because I said, how do these people know that? I mean, why would so many people want to see it on the first day? And then, of course, word of mouth was tremendous, you know, it just took off from there. And
George relates a story very similar where he was at the Hamburger Hamlet on Hollywood Boulevard right across the street from Grauman's, and he looked out on May 25th, and he was sitting there. He said, what's this big crowd for? He had no idea. He was oblivious.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he must have been eating lunch before we met up at the recording studio, because I was with him that day later. And I guess we were both bewildered by it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you recall?
But I also thought, I said, well, this is a quirky thing.
Yeah.
In 2 or 3 weeks when all the big movies come out.
Right, right.
We better make all our money in those 3 weeks. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, little did you know that the would stay in the theaters for pretty much consistently for a year.
That's amazing.
And then they'd re-release it every summer. So as kids, I was 8 years old when it was released. And
so was I.
And you said that Star Wars appealed to you as an adult because you found the humor to be rather campy.
Right.
And it appealed to you. And
well,
to me,
campy,
it was...
because remember, campy is when you are sort of set... Batman's the TV is a perfect example because they're doing it seriously for children,
exactly.
But sending it up for adults because the adults were in on the joke.
Right, right.
I thought the humor was natural. It just seemed to me that having robots that were so more multifaceted in their personalities than even me, they're all running around, but it's all your fault. I said, they're like Laurel and Hardy. They're hilarious.
Exactly. Yes.
And I'm always so serious. I said, I begged George, can I get in on the joke a little bit? Can I laugh at what they're doing? No, no, no. You're just thinking about the princess. You're single-minded. He was much more controlling of the Luke character than I think any of the others. He was most insistent with me. And Carrie's a girl. She can kind of work it out herself.
Mm-hmm.
Harrison certainly has, you know, he's so incredibly unique. But he got to change more, I think, Harrison, than I did. And I later went to him. I said, how do you do that? He goes, well, you know what your problem is? You go up to George and say, can I say this instead of that?
Right.
He goes, I wait till rehearsal, and in rehearsal, I'll spring the new line on him, and either he doesn't notice or he likes it better.
Uh-huh.
But if I went up to him and let him think about it or say, can I do this, odds are he'd say no.
Yeah.
Once he told me that, I did slip in a couple of things that were mine, but he was the master because he already worked with him on Graffiti.
How much of Harrison's personality came through Han Solo?
I thought it was a revelation. I mean, to me, he was the most interesting of the human characters because he provided sort of a modern-day cynicism that counterbalanced the corniness.
Yes.
You know, in other words, it made it all right for people, the cynics in the audience, to enjoy it because they related to him.
Yes.
Because he didn't take the Force seriously. He was in it for the money. So he was a modern voice. In fact, I think the newer ones, when I heard that Samuel Jackson was going to be in the new ones, I said, he's going to be the new Han Solo.
Right, right.
He's going to be the, I'm not going in that water. You go in that water.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought he'd be totally a mercenary and that great humor that he has. I didn't know they cast him as almost like a priest.
Yes, right, right.
And, you know, one of the things that really, I think, distinguishes ours is that we did have that cynical modern voice. And the later ones were more classical in the sense that they didn't have that specific character that would send up the rest of it.
Right, and that was something that was missing from the prequels. It was the real-world wariness that Han Solo brought to the scene that kind of made it relatable for us here on planet Earth, you know?
Absolutely. I agree.
What was it like to work in Tunisia?
Well, that's where we did our the first bit of filming before we went back to England. Harrison hadn't come over yet. Carrie hadn't come over. It was me and Alec Guinness, Tony Daniels and Kenny Baker, the robots. I mean, all the people that were in Tunisia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because we weren't there that long, but it was almost like we'd done a whole little mini movie there. And it was sort of, it took a little readjustment to get used to going back to a studio and being in civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, Tunisia is, we were following Jesus of Nazareth around.
Oh, yeah, okay. I remember that.
Okay,
sure.
And in that, they were filming because the the terrain had pretty much remained unchanged since Jesus Christ was on Earth.
Right.
So it was a paradox, I think, for the locals, because here we were in such third world conditions with robots and floating cars and laser guns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know how it played with the locals, but it really helped the crew bond. I mean, we'd been through, it's tough there.
Mm-hmm.
You know that famous story, the reason Harrison shot that guy in Raiders, rather, when the guy comes out with the big...
Right, right. The classic moment.
Yeah.
The Arabian swordsman.
Exactly. Is that, like all of us, they shot that in Tunisia.
Yes.
He had gotten the I can't get far from the bathroom syndrome.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
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 You know, you're on...
I get that on flights back from Mexico.
There you go. So you know what we're talking about.
Yes,
here.
I do.
So... an actor with explosive diarrhea doesn't want to learn a stunt, a stunt fight, you know, because it's going to take 3 hours, it's choreography, and Harrison with the rumbly stomach just went to, looked at Steve and goes, can't I just shoot him? And the light bulb went off. And to me, I think that's my favorite single moment in all of those movies.
It's solid gold, and
isn't
it really does a lot to establish the no BS attitude of Indiana Jones.
Wonderful.
Did you actually drink Aunt Beru's blue milk? And if you did, what did it taste like?
You know what that was?
Tell me.
It was, there's a kind of milk that comes in a carton that, I forget what it's called, long life. In other words, it doesn't need to be refrigerated. So you could take it out to the desert.
I think I've seen that stuff.
Yeah.
Back in my trips to Mexico.
Exactly.
Again.
Well, they add whatever they add to it, I don't know, Karo syrup, whatever it is.
Right.
I'm not really a huge milk fan anyway.
Uh-huh.
And this stuff had a sweet, almost gag you quality to it. But I thought, if I love things like that, blue milk. So I said, if there's going to be blue milk, I'm going to drink it on camera.
Heck yeah.
And so I kind of could fake it where you get some in your mouth and make a bigger swallow than it's justified. But be careful, I tell young actors, for continuity's sake, if you're going to do something in The Master that you have to repeat 20 times in close-ups and coverage, be careful what you wish for. Because that chicken leg tastes good. The first three do.
Yeah.
You know, 16 chicken legs later, you're going to be reaching for the barf bag. So, that was blue milk. And like I say, it's long-life milk, and it's meant for camping trips or places where you don't have refrigeration.
Now, following the success of Star Wars, you appeared in the infamous holiday special, wearing quite a bit of mascara, I might add.
Did I have mascara on?
Well, it appeared you did. Maybe it was the lighting. Who knows?
I don't know.
Was that just a one-day gig?
I'm trying to remember. It might have been... I do remember opting out of a song, because I said...
Oh, good God.
I don't think Luke would sing. And Carrie has a good voice. I mean, she was going to sing anyway, but...
Mm-hmm.
I you know, I don't want to bring up bad family, dirty linen, but I refused to do it. I read it, and I said, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, right.
I'm not under contract. It's awful. It's not awful. It's just not Star Wars.
Right, right.
So I don't care. I love the Jefferson Starship. I love Beatrice Arthur and Art Carney.
Yeah.
But what the heck does that have to do with our movie? And so I refused.
Yes.
And that's when I got a phone call, not from an assistant, from George himself.
Oh.
Saying, please do this. And I said, well, why are you doing this? And he said, because there's such a great demand for toys, and the toys aren't ready for Christmas.
I see.
There are no toys. That's
right.
Where, remember those chits they gave out?
Of course I do.
You had to get the figures.
Absolutely, yes.
He said, this is a personal favor to me because just to keep it fresh and keep it alive for, you know, to reassure the merchandisers, to reassure 20th Century Fox. But he was giving me all these reasons, and I thought, well, since he personally called me, okay, mm-hmm. I'll do mm-hmm. it. But them knowing that I wasn't real happy with what they came up with, my participation was fairly minimal.
Yeah.
I don't think I humiliated myself too much, but I haven't seen it since. I never saw it.
No.
I didn't watch it on TV,
okay.
And I've never seen it.
Okay.
So I should probably, because I don't know. I mean, if it's really, really horrible, I mean, because I don't want to be just mediocre. I want to be horrible. Like, I want to be in the worst movie ever. I want to be in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, oh, you got to watch this holiday special then. Because,
is it close?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me just say, have your remote control ready to fast forward at certain scenes. Because,
ooh.
I mean, You know, as much as I love Star Wars and everything, that thing was just not entertaining at all.
Oh, wow.
But it does have a campy, kitschy value these days.
I guess.
And there's a website called RiffTracks.com. It's produced by the guys who did Mystery Science Theater 3000. Right. And they did an audio track commentary to it that you can listen on your iPod.
Oh, I'd love that.
That's the way to watch this thing.
I'll bet.
Yeah, so there you go. Free plug for RiffTracks.com.
Plus, it was way long. I mean, it was like a two-hour special.
It was sick. It was sick. I just find it interesting considering your previous connection with Eight is Enough, however thin it was. But the character of Lumpy in the show, Chewbacca's son, Lumpy, looked remarkably like Adam Rich, who played Nicholas on Eight is Enough.
Wow. See, See, that was one of the kids I didn't work with. The kid that played that part in the pilot, like myself, like the director and half the family, four siblings.
Right.
The director, the person who played the father.
Yes.
All changed.
Uh-huh.
So, first of all, I don't remember Lumpy, Chewbacca's son.
No, no.
And I've seen Adam Rich, but I can't conjure up a picture of him because I never worked with him.
You also voiced the Joker in the great Batman animated series.
For 12 years.
Have you seen any of the footage of Heath Ledger? And what do you think of that?
Look, their mandate was to reinvent those characters for a modern movie audience. And making him almost like this clockwork orange psycho junkie is a brilliant way to go. Mm-hmm. So the footage I've seen, it's just marvelous. I just think he's going to be great. But you have to keep in mind, our mandate was much different. It was a cartoon for children. I couldn't kill people. I couldn't kidnap people. It was, not even...
Oh, but it was great. I mean, Batman fans everywhere love that.
What I'm saying is I was satisfied because, to me, somebody who loved the Batman comics, I thought that was the closest thing to the spirit of the actual comic books. So my Joker is really old school.
Yeah.
Really theatrical, totally into the Harlequin aspect of things. And, just the way Christopher Nolan has done so well. I mean, Batman Begins is like one of my favorite superhero movies of all time.
Absolutely.
I'm sure this new one will be great, too.
Yeah, unfortunately, haven't had a chance to see it being out here in Japan, and it just was released this week.
So to answer your question, I love the footage I saw of Heath Ledger, but he's exactly my son's age, and I didn't know him, but I'm just so melancholy over the fact that it's a posthumous performance now. Just shocking to me.
What projects are you working on right now? What's going on with the Black Pearl movie?
Well, we finally got our financing in place.
Yes.
We're going to be starting pre-production in the fall. The real goal is to make sure our eight-week shoot is before Christmas. If it gets pushed, they don't like doing splits where you do half before Christmas and half. I don't, knock on wood, but hopefully it won't get pushed. But it's been so frustrating because it's taken years and years and years and years because I want to direct it.
Yeah.
And I've only directed the movie, so it's that old catch-22. Well, what's his track record? How do I get a track record if you won't let me direct? So I wrote it to be enhanced by a low budget rather than hurt by it, for the very reason that they might go ahead and say, well, it's only 8 million, it's just not 80 million,
right.
So let's let them do it. But it's taken a long time because it's not formulaic. It's really an anti-comic book movie. It's about a disturbed individual who thinks he can do in real life what only works well in comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a disaster. It's closer to Fargo, where a guy makes a bad decision and his life becomes unraveled, than it is to a traditional comic book movie. But it's the one thing that I'm telling you, you've got to have something in life that excites you to keep your forward momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of like become semi-obsessive on my part. I want to do it so badly. And in the meantime, I'm on lots of animated series. I'm Turtle on Winnie the Pooh. I'm on this new series called Zafranc, which is I love it because it's Disney doing funny. And Disney cartoons aren't as funny as Looney Tunes in my estimation, although Donald Duck and Goofy were hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Mickey wasn't that funny to me. I love Disney going back to its roots, and they're shorts. They're like each show is like two 9-minute cartoons. So, I mean, they don't have to take up a whole half-hour storyline. And I'm working with Rob Paulson, who I adore, He was on Time Squad with me. He's one of the nicest men in show business, and he's brilliant. I mean, he was on Animaniacs. He's incredibly versatile,
mm-hmm.
and he plays this little French chihuahua who has a cooking show, mm-hmm. and I'm the Oscar Madison slobby cat who next door, whose goal is to steal his food. You don't get more basic than that. It's like puppet show mentality.
Oh, man, we look forward to seeing that. Last question, knowing what you know about Star Wars now, would you do it all over again?
Well, that's a road not taken question. I always find it hard to answer because if you leave my family out of it,
yeah.
I'd say, yeah, I'd not do it just to see what happens.
Right.
But I think it's somehow tied to how I met my wife. And if I hadn't met her, I wouldn't have had the children I had. Mm-hmm. And so no regrets. I just, it's hard. It's a hypothetical I can't really get my mind around because, you know, they asked George Harrison, what's it like being in the Beatles? He said,
yeah.
What's it like not being in the Beatles? He didn't know. And by the way, here's my George Harrison story. Because, you know, I was saying, you know, these girls that get all weak-kneed and start crying and stuff, I totally don't get it when it's directed towards me.
Yes.
And yet, when I found out George Harrison was sitting right across the aisle, I gave the note to the stewardess and said, can you give this to Mr. Harrison? I said, dear Mr. Harrison, I'm Mark Hamill. I played Luke in Star Wars. Yeah. I was shameless. But I said, I'd really love to meet you. And she came back and she said, he'd be happy to meet you. Uh-huh. So come right now. So I go over there and he's sitting in first class. And, you know, like I say, he's across from me. And I was getting really nervous. I'm thinking, if I open my mouth, I felt this lump forming, like, I'm going to cry like a little girl.
Sure.
But I managed to get out, Mr. Harrison, I'm just so thankful because your music was just so great and it was so important in my life. I just really love your music so much. And he looked up and he went, you're not so bad yourself. And I'm telling you, I could have quelled right there. Oh, my God, a Beatle telling me you're not so bad yourself. Next time we talk, I'll tell you my Ringo story.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Right.
You know what?
That's
they want you up on stage here. I'll walk you over there. We can walk and talk, right?
All right.
But, you know, that's, you know, obviously George Harrison's.
I need my jacket.
Where is your jacket?
It's in here. Wait a minute. We'll walk and get my jacket.
All right. We're walking looking for Mark Hamill's jacket as he prepares to go on stage here at Star Wars Celebration Japan. You know, George Harrison obviously being an iconic rock and roll figure and yourself being an iconic movie screen legend. It's quite a meeting of the masters.
Right.
And,
wow.
I just want to say that I kind of feel the same way right now talking to you. You're, you know, a hero of mine since
I
saw Star Wars. And I'm just really proud to have been able to conduct this interview with
you.
And I just thank you so much for your time.
My
pleasure.
It was
very generous of you. All right, we're walking toward the backstage area here at Star Wars Celebration Japan as Mark Hamill is preparing to take the stage. The house is packed. And I just want you to have a great time
for
the rest of your stay in Japan.
Thank you.
And I hope we can talk to you again sometime.
That's great.
Thank you, Mark.
And we'll hold on my Ringo story till then.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it.
All right.
All right, we're going to take a brief time out here and thank our good friends and sponsors for this week's show, Dorkside Toys. You can find them at dorksidetoys.com. They're your place for all the latest action figures from Star Wars, DC, Marvel, G.I. Joe, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I guess they call it TMNT now, The Walking Dead, and a whole lot more. Of course, the big hot thing right now is the Black Series from Hasbro, both the 3 3/4 inch and the 6 inch available now for pre-order. Plus, don't forget about Gentle Giant stuff, McFarlane Toys, Mattel, and all of the big, big toy manufacturers. They're all there at dorksidetoys.com.
All right, day 4 of Celebration 5 continues, and this is it, folks. This is the big one, especially for me. I can't tell you what an honor it is to meet my childhood hero, Mr. Mark Hamill. Mark, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. My good buddy here, Jimmy Mack, we had the pleasure of talking to you in Japan.
Right.
And right off the bat, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. You promised him a Ringo Starr story.
Sorry for the quality of my voice. I'm dealing with a little bout of laryngitis.
Right.
I know you're a huge Beatles fan.
Yes.
And you told me the George Harrison story you're not so bad yourself.
Right.
And you promised me next time we saw each other, I would get the Ringo Starr story.
Okay. The Ringo Starr story was we were in London and there was a private club. And if I'm not mistaken, it was called Stringfellows. And I'm not a big nightclub guy, but somebody had passes. And just the fact that it wasn't open to the general public, you know, had some appeal. And I thought, oh, okay. So we went and there were these sort of sunken, not so much booths. They were like semicircle couches and so forth. And I found myself sitting in a place where in came Ringo and his wife, Barbara Bach. And they sat, the owner of the club sat them right down next to me. And I'm usually, I'd like to think I'm better than this, but when I looked at him and said hello, I said, oh, I can't believe it, Ringo. I just love you so much. And I hugged him, and he winced in pain. And I realized he said, you know, in that inimitable Liverpudlian accent, you know, he said, I'm a bit damaged. And he had had a car accident within a week or so, and his ribs were all taped up. And all I could think of, here I meet the most lovable of all the Beatles, and I actually caused him pain. It was horrible. I mean, it's not a pleasant story. I don't really tell it often because it's the last thing I ever would have wanted to do. But I do keep it in perspective when I meet. I mean, I'm surprised sometimes at the passion of the fans here. And people will shake or have sweaty palms. We keep a box of Kleenex because every so often we get what we call a weeper. Where and they're tears of joy. But, you know, you don't think of yourself in that way. So, but I remember, you know, tables are turned. And, you know, I've met my childhood heroes at times that have made me lose my bearings.
You see the outpouring of support Star Wars fans have
right.
for your character in your films. Does that compare to how you feel about the Beatles? I mean, do you see the parallel?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I mean, really, when I was, I think, 11 when I first heard the Beatles, and then 12 when I saw them in Ed Sullivan, and of course we saw A Hard Day's Night, it was just overwhelming. Not only the music just made you feel so terrific, but they were so unusual. I mean, the way they talked, their sense of humor, the way they dressed, their hair, all of it. And so it went beyond the music. I want to know where they were from and how they met and how they became a band. I mean, you want, you know, so yes, it's totally relatable. I mean, not that I'm comparing myself in any way in greatness to that, but I do know when it goes beyond just listening to a record or just watching a movie where you really become sort of obsessed with getting as much information as you can yes. about any given subject.
If the Beatles were cast in Star Wars, which Beatle would make a good Luke Skywalker?
Goodness gracious. I don't know. I would probably think maybe George, because he's so sincere and he's so self-effacing, and when you look at him, you wouldn't realize he's special. John's sly and had a wicked sense of humor, and he'd probably be more in the Han Solo vein, maybe. Paul can do anything. I mean, maybe he'd be Luke. Who knows? But he's gorgeous. Maybe he'd be the princess. It's sort of a gender switch. Ringo, I don't know. Ringo, again, is as lovable as going to be. He's probably either a Wookiee or an Ewok.
I was going to say Chewbacca. I think Ringo would be a great Chewbacca. Well, I'm going to turn it over. Go on, Mark.
No. I'm just saying they're both so huggable.
Yes. Well, I'm going to turn things over to Jason.
Sure. Save your voice, Jimmy Mac.
What voice?
Yikes.
Mark, do you think that fans and folks who grew up with the original Star Wars trilogy and following the journey of Luke Skywalker tended to project themselves into the character? Was Luke such that folks felt like almost that they were the hero going on the journey, that they related to him?
Unquestionably. In fact, any good fantasy has a character that's accessible, that's not so unrelatable that people can't see. I mean, it's important to have somebody that is your guide through the fantasy, whether it's mm-hmm. Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz
Luke in the Star Wars, I thought what was so clever about it was that as this farm boy that wasn't physically formidable or, you know, with ripped muscles and 6 feet.
There was an action figure where he had some.
Well, but the point, yeah, the, sure. Really what I think what was great about it was most young children could say, I wasn't a threat in any way. You know, the Han Solo is a little scary, you know. Yeah. He's kind of a tough guy, cynical. The princess is royalty. There's a wizard who has magic. So the one character that they could say, if I couldn't be him, I could certainly be his friend, was Luke. So that was probably a smart move on George's part.
Your character has, in my opinion, of all six films, the most important, the most dramatic, the most compelling story arc. And you,
right.
And you play it so well and so subtly throughout the three films, from, like you said, the farm boy to that badass that walks into Jabba's palace at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. He's the only character that really makes a big change. Most of the characters are consistent in their personalities. Luke, I mean, people, think that when I did that whiny delivery, but I was going to tell you, saying to make them bow and get murdered,
sure.
That it was just like an accident instead of by design. And I thought, I have to sound as juvenile as I can, like an annoying little kid, so I can arc to young adult. Mm-hmm. So it was a calculated move. I realized at the time it was, you know, skirting the edge of just a complete alienating the audience. It's so annoying. But, you know, like I say, it was in the script. It wasn't because I'm anything special compared to anyone else. It's just the character.
Well, we're here to talk about the 30th anniversary and commemorate the 30th anniversary of The Empire Strikes Back. Right. And I wanted to bring up Yoda with you because when Jimmy Mack had the opportunity to talk to Anthony Daniels, he made an interesting observation where he said, you know, Ben Burtt gets a lot of credit for the character of R2-D2, but you're half or more of R2-D2. And I said, it's the same thing with Mark Hamill. You are half or more of Yoda because it's you reacting. The reason that I think fans are so attached to that character and he became so real is because of the way you reacted to him.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. I have to say, though, when I read the script, I thought, again, it's such a clever idea because here's a character who ultimately the audience discovers is almost as deep and nuanced as Alec Guinness's character. It's like Obi-Wan as a toad. But to what you're speaking of, and I felt really good that Frank Oz, who is the ultimate praise, really, when it was all said and done and put together, he took me aside and he said, if you didn't believe, nobody would have believed. Because there was very much a doubt in some people's minds when we were making it that it would get laughed at like it was a Muppet, which it was, but in a different context and much more realistic than any of the Muppets. It was, you know, a voice that was similar. I mean, for me, my ear, you know, being a big Muppet fan, oh, hungry are you? You know, I mean, I really could recognize the Fozzie Bear and the Gonzo of it. But like I say, I mean, I was there. I mean, I really believed it. I loved it. We'd go in for rehearsals on the weekends. Frank could furrow that brow. I mean, yes, it was mechanical in the ears and the eyes, but it was his masterful manipulation of basically sponge rubber. And it was very helpful to work in rehearsal with him because when we actually shot the film, the mechanics were malfunctioned so often that they'd get Yoda's close up, they'd get the over the shoulder onto him, and then when they did the turnaround to me, they'd run the puppet up to the workshop and work on it. So they put a piece of a stick with a piece of tape for the eye line. But I would remember what I had done prior in those earlier takes. Mm-hmm. But when I'm saying, but I am ready, I can be a Jedi. I'm looking at a stick with a piece of tape on it. But right. That's the technical side that people mm-hmm. don't see. But I mean, again, you're way overstating it. It's far too kind of characterization because I don't want to take credit for it in any way. But when Frank said, if you didn't believe, no one would believe, it took me aback because I there was never a question of me not believing. I just was so there. I love that character so much. I thought he was the most interesting addition to the cast in the second film.
Well, I think that affection that you had for the character as an actor really, it shows up on the screen, particularly Yoda's death scene in Return of the Jedi, which... Yeah. Still chokes me up a little because Luke is so alone at that point.
Well, also, too, I mean, I think Luke's a little embarrassed that he brushed him off like he was some water rat. You know, he's looking for this great Jedi master. Hey, what are you doing? Get off my stuff. So he's sort of making amends when he realized, mm-hmm. see, you shouldn't judge people by the way they look. All those tenets of fairy tales and fables are in there, and I'm... Like I say, I mean, that probably has a lot to do with its longevity because fairy tales never get old. Right. Snow White is as new now as it was when it was made in the 30s.
Is it true that I would imagine on both sets, Empire and Jedi, that the scenes with Yoda came down to remembering the lines and timing because you couldn't actually hear Frank?
I had an earpiece that they would comb my hair over, and they were in a trench dug into the set. It was Wendy and Frank, and I think Kathy. There were one person was Frank was doing the had the he was manipulating the face, and let's see, did he do? I think Wendy did the right hand. I mean, it's sure. getting foggy now. Yeah. My point is, I had to be right in the right. I could mostly hear. But it would drop out all the time. Mm. And a lot of times I picked up radio signals. So he would be, many years have I... And all of a sudden it would be, I remember the Rolling Stones, Fool to Cry. Yes, that was Fool to Cry by the Rolling Stones on BBC One. And he's still talking, but I'm hearing radio. Another song I remember hearing was... More, more, more. How do you like it? How do you like it? Remember that song? And it would fade in the voice, then that song, and then back to the voice, or just drop out where his mouth is moving. The first time it happened, I laughed, and I'm getting the Stones here. And Kirshner came over to me, and he said, look, we don't have a lot of time. They were so terrified that they were losing so much time because of the puppet, that if that happened again, don't react to it. Mm-hmm. Stay in character. So, you know, whatever, you know, no one can hear what you're hearing. Mm-hmm. So act like you're not hearing, you know, BBC Two or whatever right. it was. And so that's where that story came from, is because from then on, if that came up, I would just stay focused and wait for his lips to stop moving. I mean, I've talked to people that did like Italian Westerns, mm-hmm. and there'd be German actors, Spanish actors, English speaking. And I worked with Jack Elam. I said, how did you do The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly? And working with I just waited till the other guy's mouth stopped moving, and I did my line. So it's, oh, yeah. Who says? You and your brother. You know, that's how you make movies. It's all pretend.
Do you think any of the takes?
Any of the printed takes?
Yeah, actually had the Rolling Stones playing in your ear or something like that.
Undoubtedly. I mean, I didn't have a notebook and said, circle take three. But like I say, there was it wasn't infrequent. It mm-hmm. happened more and more. Just because I say the setup, it was a radio receiver. And if you, sure. you know, I would say it worked 70% of the time, but 30% of the time it was either silent or the
top 10 hits right here on BBC One.
You mentioned Irvin Kirshner, and one of the hallmarks of Empire and the Kirshner effect, as sometimes fans call it, is he added these character moments. One that he always talks about when you get the chance to see him is there's a scene on Dagobah when R2 lifts up to look inside the hut. Are there any particular things that you remember him taking you aside to just add these little doses of character
or alternate reality? Think of the answer 20 minutes from now, but
yeah.
But no, but just in general, Kirshner was someone who had an eye for detail.
Mm-hmm.
He was so well-versed in what it was that we had established in the first one. It doesn't surprise me that he added that, that he didn't say in the script that R2 lurches forward to look. But like you say, I mean, mm-hmm. that a machine would have curiosity is a nice little embellishment.
Right.
I've never made a secret of the fact that I have a special fondness for Empire because I thought it challenged the audience in a way the first one didn't. And I love the first one, but it is like, you know, put your seatbelt on. We're going to take you on this amusement park ride.
Mm-hmm.
And it pushes all the right buttons, and it's so smart the way the smallest child realizes that as soon as you get the torpedo right into the tunnel, they win.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
right.
an absolute right. button for when it happens, the audience erupts. So it's cleverly constructed that way. The second one was just more challenging. It was sort much more cerebral, and it had, I think, a lot of nuance and darkness around the edges that the others didn't. So and just the absolute audacity of having the protagonist so thoroughly defeated is a wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
And, of course, the all-time shocker of my lineage. It did throw me off, though, because once I had the mechanical hand and I had the dark outfit and the glove, I was thinking, great, the conflict in the third film will be my struggle to not go to the dark side.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought they'd go full Monty where I do something terrible. Now, I remember thinking he could kill off a major good character or threaten, like, the princess or whatever, and that would be great if, you know, the climax was him having a revelation and pulling himself back. That was foreshadowing the prequels,
mm-hmm.
where they had Anakin go to the dark side.
Right.
So
right.
I was a little disappointed in part three because I thought, oh, I don't care. I mean, as an actor, I wanted to really go there
yeah.
and become the villain. But again, I mean, I didn't know the plans they had for episodes 1 through 3.
I was 6 years old when Return of the Jedi came out. I did not see the other films in the theater. So the order I saw the films ended up being 6, 4, and then 5.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the lag with video.
So you already knew that Darth Vader was my father before that moment.
I did.
Oh, too bad.
It's still, obviously I'm here, so I didn't really miss out on anything. But one of my all-time favorite sequences in Return of the Jedi is the final duel and the work with Dave Prowse, Bob Anderson.
Right.
And someone that I've not ever really heard you talk about is Ian McDiarmid. He's a bit of kind of an unsung hero in the saga
right.
because of the role he plays. Any particular memories on those sequences?
Oh, absolutely. Would go into makeup, and I had to be there, I guess, at 7:30 and be ready on set, 8:30 or whatever it was. And Ian would already be there being made up as the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd chat and so forth. And he's, very much a theater person. And
mm-hmm.
I love the theater so much. And I talked to him a lot about that. And then at the end of the day, I just, jump in the shower in my dressing room and scrub off all the light makeup that I wore. And as I walked by the makeup rooms, there they were carefully taking the makeup off.
Yeah.
And I'd say, good night, Ian, I'll see you later. And after a few days, I realized, and I said to him, I said, unless we get together on off time,
mm-hmm.
I'll never know what you look like. Why don't you come over to the house on a Saturday? We'll, have dinner or whatever, and Mary Lou and I will take you to lunch, or we'll have dinner at home. I can't remember the specifics. And when he arrived, I was stunned because he had this bright red hair. He looked younger than me. I mean, he was so young, and he had blazer.
Yeah.
And So when he was out of his makeup, I just couldn't believe my eyes. I mean, he didn't really catch up to the age that you'd expect him to be until, again, 20, 25 years later. So he's just a spectacular actor, and I'm glad I extended myself and said, let's do that, because I never would have known what an amazing job of acting that was had I not done that.
You participated in the highlight probably of this entire celebration, the main event, where you were reunited on stage with Carrie Fisher right. and George Lucas.
Sure.
What made it ultra special was your point, and one of your points in being there was the revelation of new footage found for a Return of the Jedi Blu-ray release.
They're going to put it back in?
Well, it'll be at
or
least there as
extra.
A deleted scene. Although with Blu-ray technology, it could be a branching thing where you could have the option of watching it. You had mentioned on stage, and the crowd was so electric, I could hardly hear what you had said, but you saw the scene for the first time on a golf cart as they were taking you in. Did you have memory of that particular scene?
I when they said this, the deleted footage is you working on your lightsaber, and I had no memory at all. Then when they showed it on the computer, I went, oh, yeah, I remember that, because I had the hood on, and it was very important that you lift your head, and all you saw was the cleft chin, you know, with the lighting. So what I thought was funny when they showed it to the crowd was the applause didn't come until I turned on the lightsaber, and it was green. Because back then, we didn't really think about, you know, the color of the lightsaber is
sure.
good or evil or whatever. I thought that was amusing. I have to say, though, that it's a much better entrance for Luke than the final film. So I
think so.
Oh, I do.
Walking into Jabba's palace and doing away.
Well,
with
I haven't seen it since it was in the movies.
Okay.
So
I see.
I don't have a fresh memory of
right.
it. But in terms of everybody in Star Wars has their original entrance except for me. Because they cut out the part where I'm working on the power evaporators, see R2 and 3PO
right.
eject, and then go to the what I call the teen club. And again, people laugh because they have names for everything. You know,
yeah,
I mean, I
right.
don't know. It's Mos Eisley. Yeah. It's the spaceport. Yeah. It's the trash.
I don't really have a good memory for those kinds of things. It's for me.
No,
it's much more
and
about
I,
character.
You know,
and
to be fair, the medical droid wasn't called IG-88 until they made a toy out of it.
right.
You know, 18 months after we finished. A lot of times they didn't give names to things until they made toys of them. So this guy was Lobster Man. This guy was Butt Ugly. This guy was, you know, you made up names that stuck.
Yeah.
You know, like the we called him the Dustbin Robot. And he's got numbers now, R5D6 or whatever it is. The Calamari Man, is that still what his name
sure,
is?
Sure, right.
Yeah, because we used to say, you know, we could probably chase him around the set with a pot of melted butter and scare the hell out of him, because I would watch it, I'd get, my mouth would water, I'd really want lobster.
What's that meat taste like?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not to be flippant about it, but
sure.
getting back to your point, seeing that entrance is, it's very ominous. You know, you see the robots in the light in the background, but you see who you don't know it is. It could be the Emperor.
Right.
It could be whatever. And that communication between Vader and him, and he notices, you know, it's all, son, you know, you never call, you never write. Don't forget Dad Vader.
And it's like a Father's Day commercial.
Exactly. And I sense it. And I just think it's awesome because and it's you know I mean obviously it's too late to do it but it's a great entrance and again and I forget in Empire no that is my first entrance which is a special effects shot of riding up on the Tauntaun but that
right.
was meant to be my entrance so I have only one original entrance which is the middle one not in Star Wars and not in Jedi. And George told me specifically, you're the only one in Star Wars that doesn't have their original entrance. I don't know the facts on the other two, but he just told me that.
Mark, you have often said that you were, even back with the first film, bouncing off the walls at the opportunity to be in this movie, whether you thought it was going to... Well, you had never had a doubt that it was going to be successful,
I mean,
but your other actors didn't quite get it, it seemed like. Why do you think you were a little more receptive or open to... to its possibilities.
I was a Famous Monsters guy. I built the Aurora model kits. Mm-hmm. I loved all the Universal films, Frankenstein. I loved Ray Harryhausen, and I read Famous Monsters. I mean, it's just a different thing. I mean, I was a fan boy before they had a name for it.
Right.
And, you know, Carrie was cool. wasn't. Harrison wasn't particularly. And, I mean, I don't think they thought it was a bad movie. I said, my prediction was, this is going to be more popular than Planet of the Apes, meaning the original Charlton Heston ones. So I said, oh, this is a winner. I said, even if this tanks at the box office, it's got Midnight Cult favorite written all over it. They're going to be watching this in colleges, you know, smoking whatever and having a great old time because it was fantasy plus humor.
Mm-hmm.
When you read it, the robots were hysterical. I mean, where do robots argue over whose fault it is? I mean, it was hilarious. I thought of the princess going, you came in that? I mean, we rescue her, put our asses on the line, and she complains about what you're picking her up in? Just like a woman. You know? I mean, don't drop me off right in front of school. I don't want my friends to see me in this creepy car. Leave me off a block before. My sisters had done that. So, I mean, it was so relatable to me. Yeah. And as a fan, I said, there's no way this won't be, because it only cost, I think, $9 million or something. I said, all we have to make is like 18 plus 4.5. So if this goes over 20 or 22, we're cool. And I thought it would. I mean, I couldn't be sure. And, I mean, I never would have predicted what's happened, but I was a true believer. I said, this is a winner. And everybody's like, okay. I said, come on, what's not funny about having a big furry dog flying the spaceship next to an actor that's so brilliant that he was knighted by the queen? That's no moon. It's a small space station. I mean, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really hard to keep a straight face. And what reminded me is when you see documentary footage, like when they were cutting down Ben and so forth, we were laughing so hard all the time. I mean, it was really a romp.
Yeah.
I said, it's like the Little Rascals in Outer Space. You know, it was really so much fun. I thought, if the audience has even a tenth as much fun as we're having, how could this not be anything but a winner?
Mark, you said yesterday that you were aware of maybe the pressures or what it was like to meet some of your heroes. You had an opportunity to work with those, and you said it was always tough if they disappointed. And I just want to say thank you for being anything but a disappointment. This has been a great pleasure in my
life. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. I like the fact that you have a song, Jimmy Mack, When Are You Coming Back? My son Nathan has Good Old Reliable Nathan.
Yes.
Chelsea has Chelsea Morning. Griffin, I don't know if there's a Griffin song, and there's definitely no Mark song. So. No,
but you got Nathan's song from Guys and Dolls.
You bet. Good old reliable Nathan Detroit.
Which you did in The Simpsons.
Oh, that's right. All right. Well, no, buy the original cast Broadway album. It's much better.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Luke, be a Jedi tonight. Just be a Jedi tonight. Do it for Yoda while we serve our guests a soda. And do it for Chewie and the Ewoks and all the other puppets.
Luke, be a Jedi tonight.
Rebel Force Radio.
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
And your source for the Force.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Hamill!
Thank you very much for coming. I told you to behave. Well, thank you. Thank you all so much. Now, I hope my wife's in the audience. And I'll tell you why. Just before I came out, she said, make sure that you mention our very special memory of Empire, of course, was the birth of our first son, Nathan. And Nathan Elias Hamill was born in Avenue Clinic in London while we were making Empire Strikes Back. So it has a special resonance for us. He was followed by his brother, Griffin Tobias, and his sister, Chelsea Elizabeth. And it's shocking. You know, we've been married 31 years. Which, of course, in Hollywood is like a century. But she said to me just before I went out, she said, mention that Nathan's at a booth here. And I know it's 5:30. Is it 5:36?
Well done.
Because I'm telling you, it was something I wanted to mention. And of course, I'm overwhelmed by this response. I mean, you forget how intense. I mean, I know they're fans, but I think you guys are UPFs, the ultra passionate fans. Yeah. And I thought, you know, I was just imagining how this might go. And I said, I'm going to do everything I can to try and make you as happy as you've made us over the years and not go into the same old repetitious stories from, because a lot of times you talk to journalists, they don't care like you care. So you tend to fall into stories you've told over and over again. And I thought, you know, I bet if I sat down with you guys, you'd probably all beat me in a trivia contest.
That's very true.
Because I haven't had to learn. You know, I was really totally devoted to this project. Can you imagine? Because I remember now, I got the part from a screen test that was only 8-10 pages long. And I didn't get to read the script until they said, we want you to play the part. So can you imagine sitting down and reading the screenplay to what was then called The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, as taken from the Journal of the Will, Saga Number 1, The Star Wars. And I had a little beachfront apartment in Malibu from all my TV money that I'd saved up over the years, and I was single, and I sat down all by myself, and I opened that first page. I said, boy, they got to work on this title. It's a little hard to remember. And then I started reading the script, and I just could not believe my eyes. I mean, I had been a fan all my life. I mean, I was one of seven children. I have an older brother, two older sisters, and there's me, two younger sisters and a younger brother. And, you know, my father was in the Navy. We moved coast to coast, and I eventually went to the last 2 years of high school in Japan. But maybe it was because I needed attention being the middle child, but I always loved, the first thing I remember loving were the comic strips that would come to my doorstep every day. I think I learned to read from a lot of the silent strips like Little King or Henry, or simple strips like Nancy, Hey, You, Go. But I loved that, and I loved to draw. I thought I wanted to be an artist. I idolized Charles Schulz. I became a big Peanuts fan, and But then, of course, I loved the Universal horror films that were, of course, banned in my house. You know, you can't watch this stuff. That makes you want to watch it even more. And I loved the Frankenstein with Boris Karloff. That movie used to make me cry because I was afraid of the monster, but they were so mean to him, you know. Dwight Frye was torturing him, and it really, those were the movies that really moved me, The Wolfman, and of course Lugosi as Dracula, and I just was mad for all this stuff. And then I went into Famous Monsters and Building the Kits, and you know, King Kong is probably still my all-time favorite movie, and the issue that told you how they did stop frame animation was just fascinating to me. You know, I mean, I sort of wanted to let it be magic, and yet I couldn't stop reading how it was really done. I have, you know, reservations about making of documentaries because I like it to be magic. When you see how it's done, it's like the greatest secrets of magicians revealed. And you really want to know, and then when you see how it's done, it's kind of disappointing. So I was really like you. I was a great fan. I loved Ray Harryhausen and Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee. My mom was a huge Alec Guinness fan, and because my dad was in the Navy, they'd run first-run films on the big screen, and she took me to see The Lady Killers, and she took me to see The Lavender Hill Mob. She took me to see The Horse's Mouth. I mean, she loved Alec Guinness, so you can imagine. When I found out that Peter Cushing and Alec Guinness were going to be in the movie, I mean, I was beside myself. I remember reading the script and thinking, oh, darn, I'm not in any scene with Peter Cushing.
When you're talking about Alec Guinness, did he give you any advice? Or was it just about being in his presence?
Well, Alec Guinness, I mean, I have to tell you, would not disappoint you in any way. A lot of times you meet actors or comedians or rock and roll, anybody that is famous, and you can be disappointed that they're not the way you perceive them to be. But what's that? Oh, well, what I was going to tell you, though, is that Alec... Ooh, these are really soft.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we spare no expense. There's a couple of white afros out there as well. So,
But I know I was so terrified to meet Alec Guinness. I was so scared. And he asked to have lunch with me briefly, we flew to London. I spent about a week to 10 days doing costume fittings and going out to the sets and getting some of the preliminary work done. And they said, well, you have a lunch on Thursday or whatever day it was with Sir Alec. And I couldn't believe it, you know. I thought, I don't have a posse. I didn't have a personal assistant. I'm just going to meet the guy. And, you know, at the predetermined time, I went to a restaurant in London and met him. And I'm telling you, it was like, I thought, if I open my mouth, I'm going to cry like a little girl. I mean, I just, you know, I couldn't breathe. And I have to tell you, I kept calling him Sir Alec, and he sort of, I don't know if it was at that particular lunch or he just finally got fed up with it, but at one point he sort of tapped my face twice lovingly and the third time a little too hard for comfort. I want to be known by my name, not my accolade. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I mean, I said, well, what do you want me to call you, Big Al? I mean, come on. But that made him laugh. And that's one of the things I learned about Sir Alec. See, I can't help myself. Was that he had a great sense of humor. And he especially loved people that were not pretentious or just, you know, were comfortable in who they were. And, you know, he kept saying to me, because I would be asking him all these questions about Bridge on the River Kwai, and I knew that he had got an Oscar nomination for his screenplay for The Horse's Mouth, which he said he was more proud of that. He didn't win than winning for Bridge on the River Kwai, because it was out of his realm, because it was unexpected, you know, that he could be a screenwriter as well. So I, you know, was constantly peppering him with questions about his career, and no, I want to hear about your career. I'm thinking, what do you want to hear about, a dog food commercial in General Hospital? I mean, come on. I'd been on a soap opera. I'd done a TV series that only lasted, we did 13 episodes. It got canceled after 4. That's showbiz.
Well, you were talking about out of your realm. Luke Skywalker is out of your realm at that period. Did you do any preparation, and what kind of preparation did you do for the role itself?
Well, it was a lot of, you know, mostly for Empire was the sword, the fencing, the kendo and karate and all the... That was the physically most challenging of the three, you know, because I eventually just gave up. I thought it's like, you know, going to work and being beat up for 12 hours. because Bob Anderson, who was like the Olympic fencing champion, who was doing the sword fighting for David, he made me look much better than I was, because you know you learn the routine as if it were a choreography, and if you make mistakes, especially if you have someone that skilled working with you, he's going to make your mistakes look like it was purposeful. One of the things I'm reminded of when I look back is that the carbon freeze chamber was the way they created the illusion of it being freezing cold was with steam. So, I mean, it was like going into a sauna bath, you know, but yet it was supposed to look so cold. And that was my big problem, because I'd start fighting and I once did a Broadway musical, and all the notes I would get from the composer and the author were about sweating so much, not about my singing or dancing or acting. Because can you stop with the, because when you do the turn, your spritz is flying everywhere, you know. But, you know, I would come home and, you know, I'd have bruises on my body that looked like a relief map of Venezuela. You know, I'd take a picture of this one. You know, not that I would have anything to do with those Polaroids, but I just couldn't believe how how beat up I got. You know, I have great respect for stunt people. But
you loved that you had a zest for doing your own stunts.
I love doing my old stunts. And I mean, Colin Skeeping was my stunt double for all three films. And I was always willing to credit Colin for his contributions, because what happened was I said, I want to do everything. I want to do every stunt myself. And there were problems because the insurance people were nervous about, you know, obviously if we get hurt, then you can't continue.
The insurance on the show.
So there are things in the training of Yoda that Colin does, like springboard double flips and so forth. And I'm not one of those people that, you know, I did everything and just lie about it. I mean, I think Colin should get due credit. But the only other thing that I didn't do that I really wanted to do, because they said, can you do a flip off a diving board, a single flip? I said, oh yeah, I can do that. I've never done a double flip. But they said, well, then you can do the, when I go out the plate glass window of wherever we are in the second one.
You know.
What's that? Bespin, okay. I thought he said Best Buy, you know. I
think that was actually the same time that your first child was born.
Well, what happened was there's not, they don't use plate glass. It's a material that's a lot like lollipops, you know, so that when it shatters, it's not going to cut you all up. And below were those big, like, beacons boxes with mattresses stacked, and then a ring of stuntmen in case you bounce, they can, you know, push you back. And by that time, I'd done all, you know, I don't think I'd had a stunt double in, I mean, I had somebody standing by, but I think I did everything in Star Wars. It wasn't until the second one that they had a nervousness about it. They made me a member of the British Stunt Association. It wasn't like an honorary thing. It's because of what I did. They said, okay, you qualify. But they wouldn't let me do that because, and you want to tell, this is one time, and I just thought of this, and I want to see, you know what I want to do for you guys, because in a way you're like family, you know, it's not like, no, and I mean that, I'm not just blowing smoke here. What I'm saying is, you know, you, like me, are on the inside looking out, you see, you know, and all those other people that sort of don't get it, those are the civilians. And, you know, I feel like that being a comic book fan, too, you know, I mean, you have to... You have to understand. So one of the things that occurs to me, and again, it's not a story I tell, so, you know, I want to do that for you guys, try and come up with some unique memories. The one thing I said was, when Nathan is born, I want to have the day that he's born off, no matter, oh, sure, no problem. So she goes into labor. We, you know, I won't tell you the backstory because we were way outside London. In fact, we were at the house that A.A. Milne wrote Winnie the Pooh with Denny Lane, who used to be in the Moody Blues, and then he was in Wings, and we were friends with he and his wife. And Mary Lou Goes into Labor, it also was the place where we lost Brian Jones, the Rolling Stones. So it had great historical significance. But he got very excited. He said, oh, this is great, man. You're going to be born right where I'm just up the road where I was born. I'm so chuffed. Yeah, they say chuffed for, you know, tickled or whatever our word for it is. And so we're all, okay, great. And he drives us to the hospital where, you know, where he was born. They look at our papers and they go, you're not entitled to the national health. Beat it. So, I mean, to make a long story short, I didn't start to tell you about the story of the birth, but what happened was he gives birth, you know, so he's born in the wee small hours. You know, everything's fine, and, you know, it's time to let her rest, and the baby's fine, and so I can go home, and it's the middle of the night, and rest, and then I'll come back to the hospital in the morning. I get this phone call saying, Mark, I forget who it was, probably Gary Kurtz, we just need one shot from you today. You can go right to the hospital. We just need one shot. Please do this for us. Please, okay? And you know, I'm a team player. I'm going, well, you said I could have my day. You know, I start getting into that whiny baby. You know, I can have my day off. Hopefully I was not that annoying, but I said, well, all right. Well, if that's what you really want, I mean, just one shot, right? Yeah, it's a green screen shot, and we need it. It was basically, I was in the orange jumpsuit, and running from the big walking things. And why do you laugh?
That was the original name for them too, by the way. Big walking things was the original. Yeah.
What, that happens, by the way. I mean, a lot of stuff wasn't even named until they made a toy out of it. Seriously. We'd make up our own names. We'd call it like the dustbin robot. Or the medical droid. I mean, he's IG-88. I had to memorize that because, you know, after a while, having five-year-olds laugh at you is disconcerting. It's IG-88. Oh, okay, all right. So, yeah. But anyway, my point to you is that when I got to the set, it was second unit. The main unit was shooting with dialogue scenes. And all it was, I was supposed to be, and it was fake salt snow. I'm running, and they say, you know, run towards the camera, look over your shoulder, and then get a shot off with that, okay, again, whatever you call it. You know. The pachu gun. And I'm sure it's a toy now, and it has a number and a label, and, you know, it's $29.95. But I said, okay. And there was one Ken who was on the boom, and he was so droll, this guy. And I'm getting suited up and everything, and I'm so excited about the baby. He looks so great. Oh, Mary Lou's fine. And he goes, yeah, I'm really surprised I brought you in for a gorilla smoking a pipe shot, mate. And I said, what? He says, well, it's a gorilla smoking a pipe shot, isn't it? And I said, a gorilla smoking a pipe shot? What is that? And he goes, well, you got the jumpsuit on, you put the helmet on with the goggles, you're about that big in a big wide frame, it could be a gorilla smoking a pipe. And I said, so they have a name for that, you know, where you couldn't really tell. I'm the size of your thumb in a frame this big with the helmet on. And wouldn't you know, I do what they told me. I run towards the camera. I turn around, shoot off the pachu gun, then jump as far as I can towards camera like they tell. And when I landed, I sprained my thumb. And seriously, in the weeks to come, we did the sword fight over the, you know, the different sets over a long period of time. And so we'd piecemeal, we'd done some of it, but I couldn't hold the lightsaber properly. So just doing that gave them problems. And I'll tell you something, we had proceeded, or you know, the production who preceded us to Elstree, the studios, was The Shining. So, you know, we saw Shelley Duvall and the actors from that film, and they'd gone way over.
if you look at the movie, you can actually see the kid grow, you know. And, no, I'm not kidding. And poor Shelley, I mean, she had to be hysterical for, you know, months on end, you know. I bumped into Scatman Crothers, and of course I'm a huge Kubrick fan. I said, Scatman, because I had met him before in Hollywood on something or other. And I said, oh, Scatman, how's it going? Now, what's it like working with Kubrick? He goes, 87 takes. I said, what? He goes, Mark, I get out of the car, across the street to the phone booth, 87 takes. He goes, he said, you're a young man. And he told me however old he was. He says, I'm 73. I can't do 87 takes. And I thought, well, we move faster. But the reason I bring up The Shining was there was a rumor, and again, this is off the record. I don't know if it's true. A lot of people said, oh, yeah, that's typical of him. Because there was a fire that damaged the one of the hotel sets. And a lot of people thought that possibly Mr. Kubrick had bribed someone to set a fire to it because he loved doing insurance claims where you could shut down and not be penalized so he could rethink and, you know. He loved, one time I know David Tomlinson, who was the assistant director on Empire, said to me, he says, the reason I kind of believe that's true, he says, when we were doing Barry Lyndon, he was supposed to just hop off this little bridge into a stream, and he had him do it an extraordinary number of times. He goes, yeah, Stanley, I think you got it now. And he was saying, well, hopefully Ryan will land on his foot wrong just once. So he was actually hoping that Ryan would sprain his ankle so he could claim the insurance and shut down and, you know, spend more time. In fact, the reason that occurs to me, the reason that is connected is that the doctor who examined my thumb, you know, says, can you do this? Can you do this? No, I can't do that. Okay. He was the doctor to do the insurance claims for the Kubrick fire. And he did the examination, and everything was fine. And at the last minute before he left, he picked up a throw pillow and, in a think fast kind of thing, threw the pillow right at me. And instead of catching it and giving myself away, I wasn't faking. I just blocked it. But he said, I'm just testing you. He said, I've just been working on the Kubrick crime, so I'm a little suspicious.
A little suspicious.
Mark, you talk about Kubrick. What was it like working with Kirshner?
Well, you know, people say, you know, what's your favorite of the three? And, you know, I sort of have horse blinders on. I wanted to be fair. I thought, even then, I mean, the George told me we're out in the desert in the first week of shooting. And I said, what is this episode for? He told me, he said, well, I decided to start with the middle three because they're the most commercial. I went, ah. Okay. And he said, and actually, it was four trilogies, 12 movies, but I've cobbled it down to 9. And we talked about Howard the Duck and, you know, similar things that, you know, that we liked, comic books and cars. And I loved American Graffiti, just one of my favorite movies. But for me, when people ask that question, I say, well, it's like trying to pick your favorite child or your, you know, you love them all for different reasons, you know. But to me, Empire was always the most surprising, the most challenging, the most thought-provoking. And who would imagine that the good guys would be so defeated? I mean, that's what I thought was so wonderful about it, was the incredible surprise. And the character of Yoda was just a revelation to me. I just thought, this is such genius to... He's really like Alec Guinness as a toad. You know, I mean, he has all the depth and the nuance and the complexity of a character, and Luke, like the audience, dismisses him because of the way he looks. For many years, hey, get out of here! You know, I'm just, you know, don't eat my space sticks or whatever. And of course, you know, I mean, I was a lifelong Muppets fan. I grew up watching the Muppets.
Mark, it's just, I'm going to take a little break here because you are a lifelong fan of the Muppets, and we wanted to just screen a little bit of this. Take a look at the screens.
Hold it. You're Mark Hamill. Yes.
No. He's my cousin. That's it. My cousin, he's right outside.
But go get him. Hurry. I want to see him. Run. Oh, boy. I'm a big fan of his.
Hiya, Fozzie.
Oh, wow. Hey, you know what? You get to be the guest on this very show, right, Kermit?
Maybe. What do you do, Mark?
I've been known to do impressions. Hey!
Mm-hmm. Who do you do?
I just love impressions. Ah!
Oh, I just love doing them. Ah!
Terrific! Who do you do?
Maybe I just better sing.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
My love, for only you can end this yearning.
Okay.
Mark, actually, we have enough singers on the show.
Yeah.
I know. How about a dancing comedian? Hit it, Fozzie.
Yes, sir.
A toad with a saxophone? He got a frog horn.
Stop.
You look sort of green.
Well, I don't know exactly how to put this, Mark, but what else do you do?
I gargle Gershwin.
Mark, I know exactly how to put this. Get out! Out of the theater! We don't need you! Thank you very much, anyhow! And don't call us...
What a sadistic trick that was. Now, I don't know about you, because, you know, people always say, you don't want to talk about Star Wars, you hate Star Wars. I said, look, do you go through your old high school yearbook with any regularity? It's hard to look at yourself back when, I was probably my son's age there, but, you know, I've never seen that. I don't watch it, you know? I mean, it's just not my thing. I apologize, but that's the way it is. And I want to tell you that because I don't know so much about the current trilogy, I mean, I saw them all. They were overwhelming. But what I'm telling you is that I knew about what I did, and I was really focused on ours. And I knew my lines. I knew other people's lines. I was always asking George, you know, how come I'm living with my aunt and uncle? I was asking, where's my dad? You know, where's my mom? All that stuff. Why is the milk blue? I was really on him. And, you know, I realize now he made up all these lies just to shut me up, you know. I remember actually saying to him one time, honest to God, Darth Vader kind of sounds like Dark Father. He goes, But I didn't think in a million years. No, believe me, I'm not saying I had a foresight. I love the way I said, did Chewbacca come from chewing tobacco? I mean, you know what I mean? I asked about R2-D2, Real 2, Dialogue 2, and so forth. 3PO, is that like Cheerios? I don't know. But, you know, so I was really, really, I was very much into this and very much wanting to spread the word because I thought, this is going to be a great success, only because it's so fanciful and it's got a sense of humor. We thought it was hilarious. I mean, there's big laughs when you have a big furry dog flying your spaceship. Dude, seriously.
My question is that, like most actors, when you first read that first script, you know, did you think it was going to be as big as it was, or was it just...
I had a friend who was working at the L.A. Art Museum. Jonathan Benair was my best friend. And I said, Jonathan, can you pull, like, the top grossing fantasy films since the advent of sound, you know, from King Kong all the way through? And he brought it out to my house. We looked it over, and I let him read the script. There was no lockdown on security then, you know. Anybody could read it. But I remember making the prediction. I said, I bet you we're going to be more popular than Planet of the Apes. And I meant the one with Charlton Heston. And I thought for sure we would. I said, even if this thing tanks at the box office, it's got cult classic written all over it in terms of midnight screenings for college kids and stuff. Because up until that time, it just seems to me, I could be proven wrong, but most science fiction seems so serious. You know, it's very, you must not go, you know, Klaatu. I loved it all. I'm not criticizing it. But what I'm saying is it had a unique sort of combination of, you know, the Americans and the British. It seemed, you know, a nice mix of, you know, I said, it's like the Little Rascals in outer space. You know, we're bumping heads. You call this a plan? Give me that gun. I mean, I thought it was hilarious. I mean, it had its serious side, no question about it. And I thought it was so wonderful the way they could use something like the Force to appeal to people's spirituality without making them uncomfortable talking about religion. So, I mean, I was all over this thing. I said, I love this more than I can say. And I did think we would do parts two and part three. But going full circle now, I remember saying, I've got to go to work on the days that Peter Cushing is working, because I have to meet him, you know. Again, I loved Christopher Lee and
the Hammer House of Horrors.
All of that Hammer stuff. Again, because my parents say, you're not seeing that stuff. And so, of course, you know, you might as well just buy me the ticket and drive me right to the theater. I learned that as a parent, you know. Don't object too much because it'll...
Did you have any favorite scenes in the movie?
Well,
scenes that you participated in.
Well, I remember being how disappointed I was that there was only one take of when I swung with the princess. Is that the right grammar? When I was swinging with the princess? They had so many cameras that they did it. We were in harnesses like the way they fly Peter Pan. In fact, it was the Foy family that flew us. And she was in a harness, I was in a harness, and then they linked us together. And... I mean, I just thought, because I've always wanted, I'd seen in the movies, Robin Hood and Zorro and so many people swing across. You know, it wasn't until later, I think I saw Daffy Duck where I went, yeah, you would slide down and get a hell of a rope burn. But it was such an iconic kind of thing to do, you know, in that situation. And again, even George didn't like that they kept getting a laugh when she kissed me and said, for luck, and then we swing. And he kept getting a laugh when he was showing it to test audiences. And Marcia said to him, they're not laughing at it. He thought it was an inappropriate laugh. And Marcia, I'm so glad.
Well, your sister kissed you, so it probably was an inappropriate laugh.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, people say now, you know, if you'd done parts, whatever the numbers, I get mixed up, but if you'd done the final trilogy, first of all, there would have been more different protagonists, but George did ask me, would I do a small part in, I think, the number 9? And I said, doing what? You know, because I'm figuring it out, and I'm thinking, gee, it'd be nice to have a job lined up at the turn of the century. Because I said, when is this going to be? And in 1976, he goes, like, 2011, or, you know, something fantastic where, you know, I defy anyone to add 34 years to whatever age you are and not be shocked. Whether you're 5 or 50, that's too much to contemplate. You know, I was like, well, I guess. I mean, what would I do? And he said, well, you'd hand down Excalibur to the next hope. And I said, oh, okay. And I'm thinking, oh, I'll be like Obi-Wan's age, won't I? Meaning Sir Alec, you know. So I said, sure, what do I know? But I do think, because people said, well, you know, in the beginning I said, I should read just the screenplays and the comics based on the screenplays. I'm not reading... I think the first one was Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and then all this stuff started coming out, and I said, you know, I'm going to be pure. I don't want to be influenced by anybody but what I, you know, the person that I have to be loyal to, which is the screenwriter, whether it's Larry Kasdan or George or Gloria and Willard Hike. I guess you guys know they really contributed greatly to, which I think adds so much to the graffiti-like rapport of the originals in terms of the way we relate to one another. Because you got a farm boy, you've got a princess, you got a cynical space pirate and a wizard. To me, I said it's so much more fairy tale than it is science fiction. To me, if we'd been traveling in horse-drawn carriages, it could be set in medieval times. And then again, The Hidden Fortress, which is one of George's inspirations, you see how much it's more tied to, I think, fairy tales and fables than it is traditional science fiction. But
you talk about travel as such. Any favorite locations?
Well, I didn't have enough time. By the way, I mean, I was like 11 years old when I heard the first Beatles song, and it was on a single, The Summer of 63, before they'd really hit. And I thought it was like the Chipmunks or something, because it sounded like it was From Me to You. And I thought it was kind of sped up or something, the way their harmonies were so dissonant and stuff. And I just went mad for it. The girl up the street had it. And my sisters had 45s and everything. And she said, "Oh, I got this one From Me to You." And I just went, "This is the greatest." But there was no picture of them. And I said, "The Beatles." And I thought, "Oh, it must be like the Chipmunks." It sounded like a gimmicky name or something like that. And, of course, 6 months later, you know, if you're old enough to remember, when they did the Ed Sullivan Show, it was like you couldn't find someone the next day who hadn't seen it. At that time, it was like 70 million viewers. And it just was, I can't tell you, there's no entertainment phenomenon I've ever seen in my life, all apologies extended to our franchise, like the Beatles. Because it was everything. It was great music, great visuals. They were hilarious. If you saw their first press conference, you'd forget. All the grown-ups were, my dad said, "Oh, they're a fad. They just have long hair and yeah, yeah, yeah." They didn't think they were talented. So, I mean, I can't tell you how insulting mass media was to their arrival. So that may, again, it made you love them even more. They just don't get it, right? And their first press conference, you know, "Can you sing for us?" "No, we need money first." You know, they were, really? "How do you find America?" "Well, we turned left at Greenland." You know, my favorite answer was, and I still remember this because you're watching the news for this, they couldn't be rattled in terms of getting defensive about, because all these New York tough journalists who could care less, you know, are interviewing them at the airport. My favorite was, "Have you heard about the group in Cincinnati that's organized to help stamp out the Beatles? Have you heard about our group to stamp out Cincinnati?" I mean, these guys, I mean, they made me laugh. And all my family loved them, except for my dad. it was genius, because when Paul sang "Till There Was You" from The Music Man, she said, "Oh, now that's real music." See, they were smart, too, because, I mean, they put forward a ballad that was very romantic. Why am I talking about the Beatles? Oh, I know, because when I went to England for the first time. So, I mean, I didn't have time to really react to it. I mean, I built up England in my mind, because you'd seen it in A Hard Day's Night, how many ever times I saw then all the British invasion.
And Help, and yes.
Help, and, you know, well, you know, just I was so into the British invasion. I loved the Kinks, and I loved the Rolling Stones, and the Animals.
Yeah.
So,
Hermits, yeah.
Yeah, and that was my music. My older brother had the Kingston Trio, and then, you know, Motown for my sister, and Brenda Lee and the Beach Boys for my older sister, and it felt like the Beatles were mine. You know, they were too old. I said to Jan, "You're 14, you're over." But anyway, just in the time I had to react to being in England for the first time, then we go to Tunisia. And I have to tell you, when I got off the plane in Orlando, I went, it's just like being back in North Africa, weather-wise. You know, that wave of humidity that hits you? So it's very much like that. And what I thought was so interesting was we were following the production of... I mean, you can't describe Tunisia. It's like it hasn't changed since biblical times. We were following the production Jesus of Nazareth, that brilliant BBC miniseries about the Bible stories. And like I say, at least their costumes and set fit where they were, we'd get unpacked, and there was 3PO, R2, you know, the Jawa mobile. What do you call that? So, you know, so I kept thinking, this is, what's it called? A land crawler.
I think what you need to also, what we need to also understand is that when the mouthpiece calls it that, then that's what it was called. Then Hasbro renamed it. So that's the original. Carry on.
So you know what I want, but this is, illustrates my point. I know you guys would beat me in a trivia contest, but what I can do is paint word pictures from a first a person perspective, because I was there. And one thing that it and one thing that occurred to me, and I said, you know, I haven't told this story in a long time, because I kept thinking, something's going to happen to me before I get to go do this movie. Because when I read it, I go, I can't believe this. I'm going to get run over by a car, and my plane will crash. You know, well, something awful is going to happen. I'm not going to be able to do this. I mean, it's a dark sort of side to me. And, oh, yes, a dark side. So, and everything was fine. Everything was fine. Even the, you know, the small plane that we took to North Africa. But here's what occurred to me. And I haven't told this anywhere. So, again, this is inside baseball for all my family. We got assigned cars. And we landed wherever we landed. And we had to go for I don't know how many hours. And you have to forgive me on the exact details. But it was going to be like a 3, 4, maybe 5 hour drive from wherever we were to the wherever we were staying, to where we'd go out to the salt flats and film the first day where the Luke's little igloo house was and the sand crawler. And so I looked at the travel arrangements and they said, oh, you're sharing a car with Tony Daniels. I said, oh, great. And Tony and I got in this car, and in North Africa, there are roads that aren't two-way. They're like, it looks like a driveway. It's so narrow. And then on either side, there's no shoulder. It's just sand. So there's a little road and sand. And maybe it's a cultural thing, but first of all, this guy is driving with the pedal to the floor. So you're going over, even if there's even a little lift, you're sailing off and then hitting. And it must be a cultural thing, or it's a machismo kind of thing. You don't want to yield for anybody. They don't. So what you're doing is, if you see an oncoming vehicle, it's like he's playing chicken. He accelerates and goes right towards that car. And I don't want, I mean, it's funny now. But even 29 years later, it's funny today. It wasn't funny. We were screaming in terror. Seriously. What? Slow down. I mean, I said, Tony, you took French. Let's be careful in French. Because we didn't speak Arabic, and he spoke Arabic and French. And he's, you know, he's... And we're like too terrified. I mean, I said, this is what's going to happen. Because you couldn't see. I mean, all of a sudden, just a big truck would be upon you. Craziness. I mean, that's my tales of terror of going to the location with Tony. And I have to tell you that when being in Africa, it was Tony, it was Kenny Baker, it was Alec and his wife, it was all the stuff that you saw on the desert planet, the Tatooine. See? You never forget your hometown. So I know Tatooine, but when we went back to England, it was like we'd already made a movie. You know what I'm saying? And I know that Tony had a hard time, and I had a hard time negotiating the fact that the other actors were coming over, and I couldn't be just with Tony anymore. We really bonded over there. I mean, even on our days off, we went to a Tunisian wedding together. I mean, there's not a lot of people to hang with, and I love the crew. George was always planning. I didn't want to bother him. So we'd go out and investigate ourselves. But when I got back to England, I sort of drawn in other areas. I couldn't be as best buddies with Tony as we had been in England. And it was odd because that was our special little, our own special little movie because, you know, unless you see the actors that were, you know, in the scenes, they didn't go to the desert. And so, I mean, it was hard because you, as actors, you're paid to really relate to whatever it is. You know, it doesn't surprise me when people fall in love with their co-stars and these affairs happen and marriages break up because it's a blurry line. You really start believing it, you know, which is kind of a shocker because I know Harrison and I were really sort of like jockeying for not so much, you know, to make Carrie our girlfriend, but just to be cool around her and impress her more. I'm funnier than he is or, you know, whatever. And you can imagine my shock when I found out our status as, huh? You know, it's like that, it's the ultimate good news, bad news joke. Yes, there is an attractive woman in this universe. The bad news is she's your sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rebel Force Radio. Rebel Force Radio. Rebel Force Radio.